Today at Reader's Corner, Eric Larson, author of the new book, The Demon of Unrest, a saga of hubris, heartbreak, and heroism at the dawn of the Civil War. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On November 6, 1860, the United States was bitterly at odds. Southern extremists were moving ever closer to destroying the Union, with one state after another seceding and Lincoln powerless to stop them. The passions of North and South came to focus on a lonely federal fortress in Charleston Harbor, Fort Sumter. In his latest book, The Demon of Unrest, Eric Larson offers a captivating account of the chaotic months between Lincoln's election and the Confederacy's shelling of Sumter. Lincoln himself wrote that the trials of these 5 months were, quote, so great that could I have anticipated them, I would not have believed it possible to survive them. Eric Larson is the author of 6 New York Times bestsellers, including In the Garden of Beast and The Devil in White City, which is set up to be a Hulu limited series. Eric Larson, welcome back to Reader's Corner for a 4th visit. Wow.
It's always a pleasure.
And we look forward to seeing you at the Sun Valley Writers Conference this year. That's going to be a kick.
Totally looking forward to it. Going to bring my wife this time.
Yep. Great, great. Well, let's talk about The Demon of Unrest. Where'd that title come from?
So the title is actually a partial quote from a letter written by one of the historical figures in the book, a minor character, but I was really struck by the phrase "the demon of unrest," and it immediately became the title for the book, because it sort of captured this idea of some sort of demonic creature sowing discontent among the people. So I liked it. I liked it.
Yes, well, it works very well. There's no doubt about that. You describe Fort Sumter as a flint point for the Civil War. It's just off the coast of Charleston. For our listeners, share with us the precarious position of Fort Sumter, especially if it's off the coast of a secessionist state.
Yeah, so Fort Sumter, and there's no P in there, although Lincoln kept putting a P in there.
Yeah.
Fort Sumter was a classic. I say was, because what's there now is very different than what existed in 1860, 61.
Sure.
But Fort Sumter was a classic sea fortress, 50-foot walls surrounded by water. Construction had begun in 1828, and by 1860 was still not completed. It was a very, very imposing, gloomy structure. It was supposed to house 650 regular army troops, artillery experts mostly. But by the time it was occupied by Major Robert Anderson and his garrison, they had only 75 men to staff this fortress. And the important thing to know about Sumter, well, there are many things to know about Sumter, but one important thing to know about Sumter is that it was built initially to defend Charleston, to defend South Carolina, to defend that portion of the eastern seaboard from attack from the most likely enemies to the United States, which were always considered to be Britain, Spain, and France. And so the fortress was not built to defend against, you know, unloyal Americans coming at them from behind. So anyway, that was the precarious position that our Major Anderson found himself in.
And just to set the stage, I might comment that my enjoyment over your book was twofold. First of all, the details of Fort Sumter. That was very interesting and actually very climactic, the way you pulled it off. But the other thing is the way you helped us remember the bitter differences of opinion over slavery. And
right.
I can't think of a better place to have you go than to tell us about Charleston, South Carolina in the 1850s and Ryan's Mart. I mean, you read about that and you begin to understand what the Civil War was really all about.
Yeah. So Ryan's Mart was an auction house for the sale of enslaved blacks. It was the premier auction house in Charleston, which, however, had some 31 other slave auction houses. It was a very central force in the domestic slave trade of that period. What really brought home to me this whole aspect of selling, trading, if you will, enslaved blacks was when I went to the Charleston Historical Society. I was going through their archives, which are wonderful, but also when it comes to slavery, really sort of dark and sobering. And I came to a file full of flyers advertising slave auctions. And one in particular that sticks in my mind was for an estate sale, of all things. The owner of these enslaved blacks had died. Now they're being sold off. Like as you would like a yard sale in a suburb of New York. And so, but this flyer included it was for the sale was involved 203 enslaved blacks. And the flyer for this thing listed all of these enslaved souls by their names, ages, and if they had some special skill like cook, carpenter, whatever, they listed that as well. The chilling thing was this list included toddlers, 3-year-olds, included like 5-year-olds. There were infants, unnamed infants on this list. And when you see that, it just brings it home in a way that is you can know that slavery existed and think about it as much as you want, but until you see something like that, I don't think we really understand the magnitude and the significance of slavery to the Charleston community at that time.
Yeah. And I'll certainly plead guilty to not completely understanding the way slavery worked, at least in South Carolina and the secessionist states. I mean, the numbers that you quote at the beginning of your book, 440 South Carolina planters held over 100 slaves each. One slaveholder had 3,000 slaves. The grand total was like 3.95 million. I mean, I just, you think of slavery, and I guess it's because of the movies and what we see on film, and it's always a handful of people who are enslaved, and you don't think of these huge numbers that you bring to the fore in your book.
I mean, the largest plantations actually had essentially small, well, not so small villages, occupied by their enslaved populations. They were in enslaved families, enslaved couples,
Churches, I think you pointed out.
churches, as well. So, yeah.
Well, let's talk about that planter aristocracy that you use that term. These are the guys that are most committed to slavery for the obvious reasons. They own large numbers of slaves, and there's two of them in particular that come to mind. James Henry Hammond, who appears early in your book, Edmund Ruffin, who appears almost like throughout your book, and man, that guy really got on my nerves.
Good, good, but don't say anything about how it ends for him.
I won't say anything about how it ends for sure. I think you called them the lonely knights in an intellectual kingdom. Take it from there.
All right. So those two guys, Ruffin and Hammond, they're often referred to in passing in Civil War histories, but often they're also just simply not referred to at all. But I found them very important characters for a singular strategic reason. When you write about the Civil War, as I learned, and I don't know if you know this, but I had vowed throughout my career never to write about the Civil War, and suddenly here I am, right?
Right.
But the important thing about when you start writing about the Civil War, there is a lot of backstory before you can get to the moment of Lincoln's election, which is when the action sort of starts in my book. And there are two ways you can tell that backstory. One, just a straight expository monographic history, which would be incredibly boring and nobody would read beyond it. Or choose a couple of characters who lived the backstory, to whom the elements of the backstory were very important. For example, the advent of Uncle Tom's Cabin, how shocking that was to the South. Or in the case of Ruffin, how John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry literally saved his life and gave new meaning to his secessionist drive. So both those guys are there for a very strategic reason. Hammond, to me, embodied the worst aspects and also if there were best aspects of the planter aristocracy, which one historian, by the way, called the slaveocracy, which I think is a great term. So, but Hammond Hammond was born a yeoman, you know, but basically poor. His father was a complete failure. And there were only a couple of paths to get into the planter hierarchy if you're in that situation. One was through marriage, and that was the path he chose. So he becomes overnight, literally overnight, this major planter, a major holder of enslaved souls, and becomes a force in the politics of South Carolina in driving secession, and more importantly, being one of the foremost evangelists for what was referred to as the pro-slavery movement, which is a very important element of this whole saga, from basically 1820 on, because the pro-slavery movement, it wasn't meant to persuade people in the North that slavery was a good thing. It was meant to persuade people in the South that what they were doing was really okay. And Hammond was a foremost evangelist of that. The argument that slaves were actually in better shape, better treated than they would be if they were wage slaves in the North. And he cites all these anthropological reasons for why they were best suited to do this role in the world. He referred to them as, famously, in a speech to the U.S. Senate, as mudsills. That is that's the layer of a structure between the frame and the earth. That blacks, enslaved blacks, were the mudsills of society. Somebody had to do the menial work, and they were present and created for that very purpose.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. We're speaking with Eric Larson, author of the new book, The Demon of Unrest. And as I'm reading your book, and I'm reading how you characterize their attitude, their regard, both for their own home, the South, South Carolina, and how they regard the United States of America, the North, I felt like I was listening to a group of people talk about a foreign country instead of the southern half of the United States. And then right after thinking that, wow, these guys really didn't even consider themselves part of America anymore, I ran across your quote that you put in the book from William Russell of the London Times. I'd like you to tell our listeners a little bit about him. But the quote was, "They have the idea that they are ministers of a foreign power treating with Yankeedom." And I thought, exactly. I mean, that's exactly how the reader's going to come away from this. And I don't know why I consider that so astounding, but I do.
Well, but you're absolutely right. I mean, they had, particularly in South Carolina, they had managed to persuade themselves that, first of all, that they had a right to secede, and second, that having seceded, that of course the world would treat them like any other nation state.
Yeah.
And they actually sent emissaries to Washington to negotiate, you know, as if they were ambassadors from another land. Which was really sort of an astonishing and delusion.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, it was very powerful for them.
Right. You mentioned emissaries. I guess you're referring to the commissioners. Could you help me with just how did one become a commissioner? Were there three of them that were representing South Carolina or the entire South, or what was going on there?
Yeah, you're referring to the three commissioners who were sent up by South Carolina to represent the state of South Carolina, and they set off, you know, with the conviction that they were basically ambassadors to the United States, and they hoped to actually negotiate for the acquisition through eminent domain of Fort Sumter. You know, like this was something the U.S. was simply going to turn over to them because they wanted it, right? But something very complex, and I don't even know if I want to really talk about this because it's a very important part of the story. Yeah, I consider my book to be a historical thriller. Okay, mm-hmm. And even though we know that the Civil War, you know, is the final outcome of all of this stuff, there is a lot that's, I think, going to really surprise people. And one of the things that I found so surprising was this whole thing with these commissioners and how this played out. And just to summarize, without giving too much away, they come to Washington. They're just full of themselves. They're intent on meeting with Lincoln, with the Secretary of State, William Henry Seward, and so forth. Seward plays a very clever, canny game with them. He recognizes that if he even meets with them, that's a form of recognition of this secessionist state called, you know, whatever, South Carolina, eventually the Confederacy. He recognizes that just meeting with them, just even returning a reply to the letter that they actually submitted to him would constitute some form of official recognition. So he denies this to these commissioners, and they can't stand it. But they understand that there is this game being played, and that Seward files this very detailed response to their statement of demands and requests and so forth. He files a very detailed, uncompromising response that essentially rejects South Carolina as anything other than simply a member of the United States. It rejects it out of hand in the coldest of terms. He does not deliver it to them because he understands that to do so would be very likely to trigger a war at that moment. But he files it in the archives, the State Department archives. It's there for anybody to take a look at. The commissioners come to know that this thing is in the files as well. And they recognize that if they look at this reply, that it can only mean it likely war. So they don't come to look at it. Nobody comes to look at it for like 24 days. So there's this very, very interesting diplomatic game that Seward plays.
When it comes to Seward, my recollection from his contending with Lincoln for the nomination of the Republican presidency in 1860 was that he was quite the abolitionist. But you quote his own wife as giving him a little bit of trouble for not taking in what I guess I would call moral considerations and instead being so utterly and singularly focused on the Union staying intact that she's really disappointed, right?
Yeah. I loved that reading the letters between Seward and his wife. And she was really, really something. There's a wonderful letter from her. Seward is a very complicated character. He was convinced that, and actually most of the United States was convinced that he would be the Republican nominee for the presidency in 1860. He did not get the nomination. Lincoln, of course, did. And one likely reason why he didn't get the nomination was because he gave a particularly bellicose speech to the U.S. Senate in 1858, in which he famously known as the irrepressible conflict speech, which, as I say, was quite bellicose in terms of the North versus the South. So he was convinced that he was going to be the nominee. He did not become that. He did not become the president, but he was still convinced that he knew much more than Lincoln about how to run the country. And he behaved as such. People referred to him as the premier, the guy who really ran the government after Lincoln's inauguration. Now, you know, that was in this period leading up to the Civil War. He can be described as being duplicitous and so forth. He eventually became one of Lincoln's most stalwart and valuable allies. But in this period, it's very soap opera-ish about how what goes on.
Yeah, I guess so. Lincoln spends his days, of course, after he gets elected in Springfield. Does he truly understand what you call the depth of discontentment of Southerners over this issue?
Yeah, he does not at this point. He really has little knowledge of the South. He had, you know, visited the South in a sense on a couple of riverboat trips that took him down, I think to New Orleans. Don't quote me on that. But he had very limited knowledge of the South, had very limited knowledge of the intensity with which the South feared him and feared the dangers of abolition. And so he was very, very, very naive in that respect. Interestingly, prior to his becoming president on March 4th, you know, that's inauguration day back in 1861, you know, he let it be known that he would do nothing to disturb slavery in those states where it already existed. He went so far as to say he would also honor the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which was the object of revulsion in the North, especially among abolitionists. This was the federal law that allowed planters to go north with impunity to retrieve fugitive slaves and bring them back to the South. He made it clear that these were his positions. But the South refused to believe, take him at his word, and managed to delude themselves. Talk about an echo chamber today, you know. They managed to convince themselves that Lincoln was essentially the Antichrist, and he was hell-bent on destroying Southern society by abolishing slavery. And indeed, if he had abolished slavery at that particular time, he would have destroyed Southern society, Southern culture, as the planters knew it and enjoyed it.
Today, I'm speaking with Eric Larson, author of the new book, The Demon of Unrest. The book examines the pivotal 5 months between the election of Abraham Lincoln and the start of the Civil War at Fort Sumter. So let's get to the standoff at Fort Sumter. Who is Major Robert Anderson, and what challenges lie before him as he communicates with Washington over these many months?
Yeah, so Major Robert Anderson, he's the hero of the saga. Well, Lincoln's heroic as well, but Major Anderson is the hero of the whole saga, I believe. Major Anderson, Southern-born, born in Kentucky, married to a Southern woman born in Georgia. He and his wife were in fact former slaveholders themselves. He was very sympathetic to the South. He, in 1860, just before Lincoln's election, is put in charge of the federal presence in Charleston Harbor, and that presence includes Fort Sumter, but also other properties, Fort Moultrie, which was the only fort seriously occupied at that time, and then several other lesser forts and a federal arsenal. He's put in charge of these things, most likely because the belief was, being a Southerner, he might be able to mollify some of the superheated passions out down there in Charleston and South Carolina. But also, there's speculation that James Buchanan, the president who preceded Lincoln, that James Buchanan's war secretary, John B. Floyd, a Southerner himself, Southern-leaning member of the cabinet, might have expected that with Anderson in control there in Charleston, that maybe at some point Anderson might just, you know, turn everything over to the South and join the Southern forces, which in fact a number of Buchanan's cabinet members ultimately did. So Anderson is initially placed at Fort Moultrie. As after Lincoln's election, as the secession movement heats up, South Carolina declares secession, declares itself seceded from the Union on December 20, 1860. Things become suddenly very, very dangerous for Anderson and his men at Fort Moultrie. And Anderson cooks up this secret plot to move himself and his garrison to Fort Sumter, which is the only defensible property that the United States possesses in the harbor. And by God, he pulls it off in a very clever way. The first hint of what has happened is the next morning, when there are flames and smoke rising from Fort Moultrie, where a number of officers that Anderson left behind have set fire to the gun carriages of the artillery at the fort and have spiked the cannon so that they can't be fired. In a fury, South Carolina seizes Fort Moultrie, seizes another fort in the harbor, Castle Pinckney, seizes the federal arsenal, seizes Fort Johnson, another little old Revolutionary War outpost, and then demands that Anderson leave Fort Sumter. And Anderson says no. Anderson is loyal to a fault, not so much to the United States, but to the United States Army. He made an oath. By God, he was going to follow that oath. And that's the standoff.
And it comes down to whether or not we're going to evacuate or we're going to resupply.
Well, yes, exactly. And poor Anderson is left basically with no orders. He's a major, which is not the highest rank in the U.S. Army. And he's the guy suddenly on whom, you know, everybody acknowledges, you know, historically speaking, on whom rests the fate of the United States in Charleston Harbor. And he was not being given any direction. So, yeah, so it was quite a standoff. And the question became, he was running out of food. And ultimately, the state of South Carolina refused to give him any more. So he really had almost no option but to exit the fort. But he was unwilling to do that without conditions.
And I might say that I thought General Beauregard, the Confederate general in charge of South Carolina's military activities, was operating with a code of honor of some kind, I guess you'd call it. First of all, they were friends, and you might want to help us with that. How does that come about?
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting things about it to me, was that General Beauregard had been a pupil of Anderson's when Anderson was an instructor in artillery practices at West Point. And they considered themselves friends. Anderson considered Beauregard to be his favorite pupil. Suddenly they find themselves, Beauregard is put in charge of what became known as the Confederacy's forces. Anderson, of course, was in charge of the federal force at Fort Sumter. They're by definition now on opposite sides of this conflict, but they're still friendly. Their letters are laced with, you know, with gentlemanly concerns and just sort of very kind expressions of goodwill and so forth, even though throughout the spring of 1861, Beauregard was seriously installing artillery batteries on all the land promontories around Fort Sumter with the intent of destroying the fort and, if necessary, Anderson and his men. But it was all very gentlemanly.
There is something about Sumter that is well known, and I think you point out at the close of your book, the greatest of ironies regarding the actual bombardment of Fort Sumter.
Yeah, the fact that 3,000 shells and cannonballs were fired at this fort in basically 30 some hours, and nobody was killed. Nobody was killed. And yet, the next day, two were killed in a circumstance that once again had to do with honor. You know, it was during a 100-gun salute that Anderson had insisted on. A cannon misfired and killed one soldier right away, and another died later. Those were the two deaths, and both occurred because of this obsession with honor on both sides of the fence.
I read your closing where you give credit to so many people who have written about the Civil War, and there's one woman in your book that is very interesting, Mary Beard of Charleston. Tell us about her diary and what role it plays in your own research, for that matter.
Yeah. So Mary Boykin Chestnut is the preeminent female diarist of the Civil War era, and typically Mary Chestnut has been used by historians to comment on events as they unfolded. You know, it's just offering a quote here or there. But I found her diaries so compelling that I felt that Mary Chestnut really needed to step forward and be her own character. And when I say character, I'm not referring to a fictional character. I mean, you know, an actual historical actor. It's just easier to say character than anything else. But I wanted Mary Chestnut to step forward as a historical character in her own right, to offer us insights into Charleston society, into life, into the world of slavery and what it meant to planters and so forth. But also, she's in there because she's just a wonderful diarist. I mean, very contemporary voice. She refers at one point to one of her fellow society matrons as a miscreant. And anybody who does that is going to be in my book. I don't care.
That's right.
What role she plays, but she's a wonderful counterpart. And you know, sort of her analog, her male analog, you mentioned earlier, is William Howard Russell, near London Times war correspondent, who enters the story fairly late in the game when his editor, recognizing that things are happening in the United States that could lead to conflict, wants this guy, William Howard Russell, the London Times' most famous war correspondent, and actually arguably the world's most famous war correspondent at this time, wants to send him to America to keep tabs on what's happening. And at first, Russell does not want to go. He's got a good life at last in London. He wants to be there for his kids. He's got great life with the intellectual life at the club. He's friends with Thackeray and so forth. But ultimately, you know, he decides to go, probably because Thackeray says, you know, this is an opportunity that you should not miss. So he goes to America. And what's so wonderful about him is his observations of the key players of the time, like Lincoln and Seward. And when I say observations, I mean his physical descriptions of these people are just virtuosic in terms of their detail. And so he really is sort of Mary Chestnut's analog.
Well, I think your book is virtuosic, and that's the reason why I can't recommend it more highly than I have to all my friends and family. The name of the book is The Demon of Unrest, A Saga of Hubris, Heartbreak, and Heroism at the Dawn of the Civil War, by Eric Larson, who has been so kind to join us today for this conversation. Eric, thanks so much for being with us. Look forward to seeing you in Sun Valley.
My pleasure, and thank you.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the issues and ideas that shape our world at Reader's Corner.